Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 288 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore, and the Mets are still bad. But we're here anyway, getting through this together. So first up, Chris McShane and I talk about the state of the Mets, who we think will be traded, and who, shudder to think, we want to win the NL East.
Well, Chris, it's been a while since you and I have been on the show together.
That's
and,
right.
I guess the biggest bit of news since then is the Mets are even worse than the last time we were on the show together. When did you throw in the towel for the season?
Probably a little earlier than you might have guessed.
For longtime listeners of the podcast, knowing you as the optimist of the group.
Yeah, but I'm looking. Let me see. To answer this question, I think I have to look at actual like dates in the standings. It wasn't a friend of mine had said to me that he gave up when they blew the lead in Toronto in the first of the two game series, and I was like, all right, that's extremely late. I gave up a lot sooner than that. You know, but let's see. Let's just play around with the standings and go back just a month to June 5th.
That and, was right after the Cubs series.
Yeah, it was pretty bad, but there are four games under 500. You know, many teams out of the wild card, but still, you know, we all know the bar for contention is really a 500 record or slightly better.
Right.
So I may have kind of given up at that point, you know, because just this date that I happened to pull up. You know, they had lost five in a row. They had gone 2-8 in their previous 10 games at that point. You know, they'd really completed, well, so we thought they'd completed the drop from relevance into the abyss. And, I think around then, I'm trying to think, I may have had tickets to that Friday night game. Which would have been on June 5th, and I think I just didn't go.
No, Friday night wouldn't have been June. Wasn't June 2nd was a Saturday.
Oh, yeah, good point. All right, so
June 1st was Friday night against the Cubs, so I was at that game.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, yeah, somewhere in that vicinity. That's right. So the first, we thought about going and meeting up, yeah. And you had gone, and I had gone the night before, and it was just miserable. So I think somewhere right around there was probably when I had started to give up. And then, I mean, just they won five games in June. You know, it was just and like I'll still watch if I'm home and, you know, nothing else specific is going on. But, yeah, no, it's. It's vague. Somewhere in between that Cubs series and, you know, a lot sooner than this week. And, it, you know, it's kind of crazy to think it may didn't go well, but, you know, they got to the end of it and they were still around, you know?
Yeah.
Even just going back to June 1st, they're 27-28. You go, okay. They slipped below 500. That's still really bad considering how they started the season. But, you know, it's not a death sentence. Look at it this way. On June 1st, the Mets were a game ahead of the Dodgers.
Wow.
And do I even want to do the math on what the difference is today? 11.5 behind the Dodgers.
Jeez.
So it's just, you know, and it all makes sense, I guess. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, now you're looking like not only are you thinking, okay, you trade guys because you're obviously sellers, but, you know, you're looking at it like, well, nobody has a shot at the first pick other than the Orioles and the Royals, who are just, they make the Mets and Marlins look fantastic.
Right. But you're thinking a bit of a top five draft pick.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a good chance of it. The Reds, Padres, and Marlins are all pretty bad. And if the Pirates, I haven't really checked in on the Pirates roster in depth lately. You know, if they sell, they could be a team that maybe drops a little farther out of it. You know, the Nationals are lucky to be 500. We'll get more to them in a little bit here. But, yeah, it's just I've had the bad Mets feeling. I don't recall a season that had as good of a stretch as they started with and the feeling that we have now in the same year.
Yeah.
There may be one, but I don't remember it.
I feel like there's just a level of expectation that plays into all of this. Like, you know, I went to a lot of games in 2010. I know what it's like to root for a bad Mets team. You know, I grew up, you know, the first couple of years I remember being, you know, an active Mets fan were like, you know, and I was 4 and 86. So I don't remember that, you know, but I remember, you know, the 89 through, you know, 93 Mets. I know bad Mets teams. This isn't new to me, but this just feels dire in a way that no other team of recent memory feels to me. I guess because I still believe on paper this team looks pretty good.
Right.
Like, if, you know, all things considered, this team doesn't look terrible on paper. And the fact that they are just unimaginable. Like, yeah, I could never have imagined the team being this bad in this many different ways, especially right after that start.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, it just kind of, it leaves you at a loss for words, which isn't necessarily the best thing for a podcast, but you know, you look at it and you go, how is this a team that, you know, we were talking about with so much excitement? And, you know, when we were in San Diego, I was thrilled to go to all three games, and, you know, they won two out of three. That kind of feels like the last good moment the season had was out there.
I remember us talking on the podcast at the end of April with you saying, like, I really hope they get to 20 wins in April.
Yeah.
And that seemed, 20 wins in a month seemed like an achievable goal for this team. And
yeah, I mean, that was, the ask there was basically win most of the remaining series in the month.
Yes.
You know, so they could have afforded, you know, maybe lose one series, win the next two, or whatever it was. You know, it wasn't that far away. And to give some perspective on that, one, they're only at 34 now.
Exactly.
And it's much later. And when we talk about how bad other teams are, Baltimore has 24 wins. Oof. In July. And like a few days into July, that's, yeah, I don't even know, man.
Yeah, at least we're not Orioles fans.
Yeah, I mean, Camden Yards is really nice to have.
It is.
But there's a much longer road to coming back there. You know, we have trade rumors in our own universe here, but the best player they have seen in, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, going back to like Ripken's heyday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah. He's about to not be an Oriole anymore.
Fan is screaming at their podcast right now. People thought Adam Jones was going to be the thing for a while. Remember that?
Yeah. And he's been a good player.
He's been a very good player, yeah, but not.
Yeah. Machado.
I believe it was Jay Jaffe. I'm going to throw some shade at Jaffe, who I love, but I believe he said that if you look at just pure physical athleticism, he's a better player than Willie Mays.
Okay.
I believe that was Jaffe that said that at a BP event one time. So, sorry, Jay. but yeah. Man, the Orioles are bad.
Yeah. But it all ties in nicely to everything that we want to talk about.
It does. It's actually very convenient. So I guess let's begin by talking about the Mets trade rumors of their own. So a few weeks ago, there were rumblings that the Mets were going to listen to offers on DeGrom and Syndergaard. And Well, I think that was always pretty tough to believe. Recent leaks from the front office say that they have since moved on from that idea, and thank goodness, because that would have been very, very ugly if it had actually happened. Even though I think we can all agree that Syndergaard is a more exciting pitcher to watch day-to-day, I feel like if they traded DeGrom, that would have hurt more.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. You know, the year that I finally give in to accepting, not that I ever disliked him at all, but just accepting that, okay, you can just say DeGrom is the best pitcher on the team now. You know, yeah. You know, it's a situation where he's just, I mean, now I'm like, he might be the best pitcher in the game.
Yeah.
So yeah, you look at it, he's obviously proven himself to be more durable. You know, I hate to write a guy off as being injury prone after, you know, a couple of injuries, but when these two seasons are over, Syndergaard is going to have about a half season's worth of work in total.
And DeGrom will have two seasons worth.
Right. You know, or maybe three quarters of a season for Syndergaard, but, you know, same concept.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the durability has been better and the results have been better. And, you know, people who are getting on Syndergaard for not being good enough early in this season, I think were
insane.
Yeah. So it's not a knock on him at all, but there is a clear 1-2. And I think Syndergaard could be the ace on a whole bunch of other teams. So to say that he's not the ace of the Mets is not an insult. But yeah, you know, trading those guys, one or both of them, and especially DeGrom, is just really, you know, waving the white flag, not just on the era, but, you know, the pressure to get that right, you know, it would be immense.
Yeah.
You know, like Syndergaard and Darno were traded for R.A. Dickey at a point in his career that he still had several good years in him. I think his work gets maybe a little underrated in, you know, the post Mets era, for him, but you know, you heard Syndergaard, Darno come over and at least answer questions about, I don't know whether or not they were really feeling it, but at least answer things about being traded for a Cy Young Award winner and the pressure that exists there. You know, if you're coming over as one of two, three, four guys for DeGrom, you're not just expected to make it. You're expected to be
the future, you know, franchise.
Right. One of the best players in baseball. And that's a lot. You know, I think it can weigh on a guy.
Not only that, but I mean, with the exception of the Darno trade, rather, can you remember the last time for the Mets a dump a star for a package of prospects worked out all that well?
Well, yeah, Beltran and Wheeler.
I guess I was thinking more of a that was a rental. That was a it was a one for one deal. I'm talking, you know, we're getting rid of our best player for a bundle of prospects type deal.
Yeah, I don't even know. When have they done that?
I mean, Seaver.
Well, yeah, okay, yeah. I mean, that predates me,
yeah,
and you.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of a time that they've ever really sold somebody of that caliber.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like trading DeGrom would be as dark a day as trading Seaver was.
Don't let anybody over 40 hear you say that. Because Seaver in a way that you know, that I can't fully appreciate because I never saw Seaver pitch in his prime.
Right, and Seaver does get, I think, slightly overlooked. It's hard to say that about somebody who's in the Hall of Fame
and who had the highest winning percentage of any player until Ken Griffey Jr. getting into the Hall of Fame.
Right. So, you know, I feel like it's hard to say that, but. At the same time, you look back and you have guys who had shorter careers or weren't quite as great as he was, you know, who maybe get considered a little more highly in the best pitchers of all time rankings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I get it. But I think it's the closest thing we could feel to that.
Yeah, because, you know, he DeGrom hasn't had the fall from grace that a Doc Gooden had or that Darryl Strawberry had. You know, he hasn't had the injury history of a David Wright or someone else who was considered to be a franchise player and then, you know, on some level disappointed, even though I never want to hear David Wright hear me say that I'm disappointed in him. I don't mean in him, I mean in his body breaking down on him. But, you know,
it's just
to give up on a player in their prime of that consequence just seems really, really like throwing in the towel for, gosh, half a decade, maybe more.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's so rare that a team hits on a pitcher of that caliber, let alone the Mets have done it a couple of times now, and arguably did it with Harvey also before he got hurt, arguably did it with Wheeler, or, you know, Wheeler's looking right now as good as he's ever looked, you know, so the fact that the organization's been able to develop this many starting pitchers is really a miraculous thing, and to give up on the best two of them would be a real, real blow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's and, you know, the other side of it too is who's making the call on what the trade return is now? You know, and obviously we hope Sandy Alderson recovers fully and is healthy and you know, wish him nothing but the best on a personal level. You know, on a professional level, he's not involved in the day-to-day decision making, you know, for at least the short term. And two, you know, I think the last 6 months to a year of his performance on a professional level was not his best work.
Agreed.
So, you know, you have sort of a trio of guys plus the COO, who's, you know, part of ownership, obviously.
A particularly meddlesome part of ownership.
Yeah. And, you know, so you're entrusting a very important decision to, I don't know, what's the best way to frame it? An unknown quantity in the front office is that I think that's the nicest way anybody could say what that situation is like, you know, I don't want somebody trying to prove themselves as the successor for general manager in meetings about who they should trade, you know,
right.
Somebody like that for.
I mean, Rob and I talked a little bit about this last time, but it's a really odd mix of guys that are in charge right now, because you get the impression that Ricciardi is the Alderson guy who's sort of the last man standing from that regime, right? Rico predates Alderson in the organization.
Yeah.
Minaya obviously has a different relationship with ownership than Alderson does. And I wonder how equal those titles are right now. Do you have any sense for that?
No, I don't think I have any sense in terms of what they're, you know, feeling internally. Also, just a quick aside, I think Terry Collins might be the happiest man on the planet right now. He looked pretty damn happy in spring training to not be managing, you know, anymore. And man, the way this has gone, woo! But back to the GM side, yeah, cripes indeed. But back on the GM side, I don't know. I don't have a sense of what the dynamic there is for them. I know that Ricciardi would be my last choice.
Why? Just because of his Toronto failure?
Yeah, there was some bad work there. I don't know. It's just one of those things. Can't put my finger on it, but you know, he just seems to be, I don't know. He's not my kind of guy. And I'd rather, I don't have a good enough sense of Rico. And then Minaya obviously had his, you know, his pros and cons as GM, but I think he sometimes would freeze up in front of a mic to the point that people thought he was not smart. And that's definitely not true.
Right. Right.
You know, whether or not the baseball decisions were always sound, we don't know. Is a mixed bag. What we don't know is how much interference he had to deal with. You know, if there's ever a Sandy Alderson memoir, or if the, you know, if the Mets ever are sold to any other ownership group,
and there's a tell all about this,
yeah, then I think it might be easier to properly judge the performance of these general managers. You know, I think it's hard to do in the, you know, current landscape, but yeah, I mean, my first choice would be that they would go find somebody new who's outside the organization, and somebody who really commanded autonomy of the entire baseball operation. You know, I don't know if that's realistic, but yeah, no Ricciardi is my vote.
See, I think in this particular moment, I think Ricciardi might be the guy they need, because I feel like Ricciardi is the only one. I mean, look, we don't really know Rico's style as a GM. I have to point out once again, his mom and my mom are pals, so I have a personal affinity for him just because my mom's friends with his mom. But I don't know what kind of a GM he would be at all. I think that Ricciardi has I'm going to use a bunch of buzzy phrases that I fucking hate, but like, I think that he has the ability to think outside the box a little bit more in these ways. I think because he comes from such a sabermetric background, and because he worked with Alderson and Billy Bean and saw how things were done in Oakland when there wasn't a lot of money to be thrown around, I think that when the team finds its back against the wall where it has to trade some players, but it doesn't want to trade its superstars, but there's no, you know, real natural fit for what they need right now at the major league level, I think this is the type of guy who might be able to look at things a little bit differently and make a trade that will be less expected, and therefore possibly, you know, we used to love the term of, you know, all this sort of fleecing general managers for different things. I think those days are over, but I think if anybody's going to come close to fleecing somebody in this front office, I think that Ricciardi's the guy to maybe do that for this particular moment. I don't want him necessarily running the team next year, but I think at the trade deadline, Ricciardi might be the best bet the Mets have.
Okay. Yeah, hey, fair enough.
Maybe. You know, who knows?
Yeah, we're not dealing with an ideal situation here.
No.
I feel like I've said situation a lot. That's probably not a good thing when you're talking about a baseball team in July.
Yeah.
The situation. Actually, we're talking about the season, and then we're just not.
Yeah. So who do you think are the players most likely to be traded?
Struble Cabrera, you know, and I know I wrote about it a little bit on the site, and you know, I know there might be some sense of like, well, who are they going to trade him to, and you know, where does he fit? But switch hitting guy who's hit well, really well this year, really well overall in his time with the Mets. You know, I'm not saying anybody's going to give up a boatload for him, but you know, that's an asset to have. He is definitely better than the 25th man on, you know, a few rosters. So even if you're not getting him to be a starting guy, you know, I'd rather have him around as a part-time player and, you know, insurance if one of my better guys gets hurt. So yeah. I think he's a no-brainer to go. You know, at a time that we are very much reflecting on the bad moves, signing him was probably one of the best moves that Alderson ever made.
Yeah.
and I don't mean that to, you know, I don't mean that as an insult at all. He signed a very, you know, team-friendly contract for a player who, you know, has performed well. And, you know, I know he's not a defensive wizard in the field, but I think he might get knocked a little bit too much for defense. And he's just been a really solid hitter, you know. So, yeah, I think he's probably the most likely to go. I would assume Familia goes too. You know, teams have made dumb trades for relief pitchers when they're contending, sort of like a time-honored tradition in this game. And as long as his shoulder doesn't completely fall apart, you know, if he just stays on the field and, you know, you're looking at his numbers, the ERA is a little higher than usual, but, you know, strikeout, walk, home run rates are all pretty normal. I think there's something there. So those two, you know, those two are good, I think. And then maybe some of these other guys get traded. Jose Bautista's performed better than anybody expected. You know, in an alternate timeline, I'm not sure if the alternate timeline gets you to a point where you sign Jose Bautista, but say just one, you know, say it was just everything's going great. Cespedes has the leg hip issue come up and the Braves released Bautista, you know, but that just that part of the thing stays the same. Then you'd look and go like, oh, wow, they, you know, they signed this guy for nothing. And, you know, he's doing a much better job than expected of filling Cespedes' role in the lineup, you know. Mm-hmm. So, again, not thinking you're going to get a ton for him, but in a season where the Braves are contending for the division, you might be able to get some minor leaguer back for a player the Braves released after sort of, you know, insisting they were going to play him every day and then releasing him 12 days later or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So it's the small victories. And then I guess last but not least, Blevins, he is left-handed. He is a reliever. Again, teams contending, making stupid trades for bullpen arms. It wouldn't shock me. Anybody who you think you'd rank totally differently or just somebody I didn't mention who...
There's a lot of talk about Wheeler being a potential trade target.
So yeah. That.
And Wheeler's an interesting case because I don't know if he's ever put together a string of starts as good as his last. I mean, you know, regardless of results, because we all know pitcher wins mean nothing, just look at the way he's pitched the last month, a month and a half. He hasn't looked this good in years, if ever at all. Like, his most recent start, he looked as confident and collected as I've ever seen him. And that's a really great thing. And you're frustrated that it's happening during this season, but he might be able to legitimately get the Mets something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the other stretch that he had that was along those lines was the one, you know, before the injury... 2014, he throws that complete game shutout. And from that point, June 19th through the end of the season. Now, granted, he didn't make, you know, he didn't throw the most innings, but it was 18 starts, 2.93 ERA.
Yeah.
And that included a couple of stinkers in the mix, to borrow one of Keith's favorite terms. You know, and still.
That was at the time when Wheeler was throwing so many pitches because everybody's fouling off his pitches, whereas now he seems to have cut down on that. And so you hope some of those stinkers may fade away.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is probably the best he's looked. You know, I'd still trade him. I don't dislike the guy.
Left?
Beyond this year, I just don't trust that he'll stay healthy.
Yeah, I know. I'm just trying to figure out the sort of
package. Is it one or two after this year? Let's be accurate. Yeah, I've practically memorized the exact circumstances of DeGrom and Syndergaard, but I don't know. Wheeler is just 2019.
Yeah, then I'd trade him.
Yeah. I mean, worst case scenario is that he's great next season, and you know, we're saying we would trade him, assuming that there's some real return.
Yes.
Some team is willing to take the risk that, okay, you know, he's not been a healthy guy for a lot of the years he's been in the, you know, in the major leagues, but you know, we think for the next year and a half he can be a really good pitcher. And you know, he's not making that much money. You know, his last year of arbitration, he's going to probably make, I mean, he's at about two now, so.
Yeah, that's an incredibly valuable.
Four, place. Five, six, you know, somewhere in that range. It's not like he's going to make 10, 15.
One of the things that Ronnie said on the broadcast the last time they started was that, you know, he knows a lot of the scouts around baseball. A lot of them he played with are just, you know, guys he's encountered. And he says that when he comes to a city and he sees an old buddy who's a scout, they never ask about Syndergaard or DeGrom. They always ask about Wheeler.
Huh.
And, you know, that's really interesting. I wonder if there is a real viable trade option there for Wheeler. I think, I don't want to use the term blown away because that's overselling it, but I don't think you're trading him for what you traded Granderson or Bruce or Duda for last season. I think you have to see a real prospect back for Wheeler.
Yeah, it would have to be something of a different tier.
Yeah. There's also been talk of trading Matz, but I don't know who would necessarily trade for Matz. He's such an unproven commodity still. And again, health concerns, etc. I don't see you getting much for Matz, do you?
Not really, no. I mean, I don't think there's a huge gap between the two of them. You know, Matz has the better overall numbers this season. Obviously, Wheeler has looked much better himself recently. But yeah, they're both guys that I just can't trust to throw not even 200 innings, like 170 innings and be healthy if you're in the playoffs. So I just don't know how I can. If some team is willing to give up anything real for either or both of them, then
you take it.
Yeah, have at it.
It's going to mean some ugly starts down the stretch.
Yeah, but that's okay. I mean, I'd rather see Flexen and Oswalt just, you know, giving it a good go for 2.5 months or 2 months if it, you know, if they wait until the actual deadline to do these things. You know, I mean, the one thing with Matz, again, I wouldn't just sell low. They have three more years of control on him after this year. I don't know what to make of him.
I have no idea.
But, you know, it's I'd still trade him. I mean, to me, I want to keep DeGrom, Syndergaard, Conforto, Nimmo, and those four to me are definitely part of the equation, and I'm not giving up on Rosario. It's just, you know, if there was a situation where somebody valued him as highly as he was valued, you know, when he still had prospect status, then okay, you know, you can talk about that. But you gotta remember, he's still really young, and you know, the email, we'll hit on that a little bit more.
Yeah. Do you want to jump right into that?
Sure.
All right, so we got an email from our pal David, and he said, "Hey guys, if you were in the Mets' crowded GM suite, would you trade Rosario for Manny Machado? And do you think the Orioles would take that deal straight up? I know Rosario was such a well-regarded prospect, but essentially a year in now, I don't see it. I really don't want him playing short for the next 5-plus years for the Mets. With Machado, sure, Mets are currently extreme outsiders to sign him long-term, but I think it becomes a possibility if he plays here for 2 months and enjoys it. I still hold out hope that the player of Machado's caliber, together with the core of DeGrom, Thor, Conforto, Nimmo, and we hope either Cespedes or Bruce could contend for the division. What do you guys think?" Chris, you want to start with this one? Or you want me to take it first?
Sure, well, I can start. I mean, first they would get slaughtered for doing it, which, you know, doesn't mean generally that it's, you know, the wrong thing to do. But, man, that's a big risk to take. You know, I don't know if you can make Manny Machado fall in love with things, you know, the way that Cespedes probably did. And, you know, the Mets ponied up money and paid him to remain a Met. But he came here and enjoyed a really good run with the team.
Right.
So if there were a tiebreaker, you know, that may have been it. Is Manny Machado going to see Tim Tebow in the outfield and, you know, a stadium that has 5,000-10,000 people in it? Although, hey, if Tebow's there, who knows? I don't know anything anymore about what's appealing. So maybe, you know, maybe they sell the place out with Tebow. I have no clue. But, but yeah, I don't know if this is the environment to entice Machado to stay. So I get the point, you know, similar to Cespedes. This isn't a guy who you have any shot at unless you had him here and sort of, you know, gave him the best possible experience. I don't think the Mets are capable of that right now. And, you know, we're in a season where I think the manager is not guaranteed to manage beyond this year. I'll be surprised if they fire him, but he's not been good. So I don't know.
The whispers out there are that he's not very popular among the players either.
Yeah, it there hasn't been any really good angle. I mean, obviously, you can give him a little bit of you can write off the fact that he has the roster that he has. Mm-hmm. But man, he's gotten snippy over some, you know, some stuff that the questions that have been about things that he has messed up. I forget what it was. We talked about it on the show. But do you remember the specifics early in the season?
Was it that he didn't double switch or something like that? No, yeah, no. He sent Jay Bruce up to pinch hit when he knew he'd be intentionally walked. Well, not he knew, but when it was clear to everyone else watching the baseball game that they would just walk Bruce in that situation. And he burned a pinch hitter in a situation where there was absolutely no reason. And Bruce was dealing with his plantar fasciitis, so you're essentially putting Bruce in as a base runner for a guy who couldn't run the bases effectively at the moment. I want to say that's what it was.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And then the reaction to it was, like, kind of cutesy, I remember it being a moment that I just said, okay, I know what I want to hear him say. And I think that was exactly the situation. But just in case it was something different, you know, whatever it was, I wanted him to say, you know what? You guys, you're right. I made a mistake. And he just didn't own it the way that I had hoped. And, you know, I don't know. He just hasn't been good strategically. He hasn't been good at selling stuff. You know, and I know with like Reyes, he's got to toe the company line and all that. But to go back to your earlier question, I think when I gave up on the season was when Alderson gave the press conference where he brought up Jose Reyes himself.
Yeah, that's probably good.
And I was like, all right, that's enough. You know, this is like, I can still appreciate it because it's professional baseball, you know, that's available to me. But
it's funny, but, you know, I didn't answer my own question about when I gave up hope. And it was when I totally lost faith in Alderson, and it was that press conference, and that's when I gave up hope.
Yeah. I think that, you know, if we're looking for the moment that Lisa rips Ralph's heart in half,
yep,
I think that was it.
Aw, nothing gets chocolate out. See?
this is a horrible
tease for podcast listeners, but off the air, say dare officer to me.
Okay.
I have a story for you, my friend.
All right, but the Machado thing, we got off the rails.
We did. I don't know. You know, I can't see a world in which Machado signs with the Mets, whether he's playing here for 2 months or not. So you're risking potentially a really, really good player, even though, you know, I understand he has not shown it just yet offensively. But I think that you could make a case for Rosario being the, you know, like you said, you mentioned the big four you'd want to build around: Syndergaard, DeGrom, Nimmo, and Conforto. Rosario is the natural fifth spot for that. So you're talking, you're going to possibly give up the fifth or sixth most important player on your 40-man roster for 2 months of a guy that's, and a guy that, even if he plays like Mantle, you're probably not going to make the playoffs with him this year. I don't know if I could make that move. Just hoping the fact that he enjoys New York, I don't know. To me, you almost have a better chance of landing him if he didn't play here for the last 2 months of the season. Because Can you imagine anything worse than playing like in 95-degree hot City Field to, you know, 6,000 people? It's just not going to be a pleasant experience. I think if the long-term goal is to get Machado, the only thing standing in your way between that as a free agent is ownership's ability to pony up and, you know, and to sell New York to him. I don't see how trading for him does that.
Yeah. The only thing I'll say is that if the Mets know that no matter what, they'd really prefer Jose Reyes for the next 5 years, and then they're just going to burn Rosario's career, then sure, go ahead and do it. But
that's the most disgusting sentence I've ever heard you utter.
Well, you know, they've stuck with him this long. But yeah, I do appreciate the sort of outside the box, thinking with the email. And
oh yeah, yeah, it's a fun thought exercise.
Yeah,
I
think in the end you're giving up Rosario being, let's hope, just a good major league shortstop, which is a compliment.
Yeah.
Again, that's not an easy thing to do. And maybe more to, you know, maybe decrease your chances of signing Machado. You know, you might be able to sell him. Okay, in the winter, you can just sell him on, here's the most money.
Right.
And, you know, New York is awesome. And, you know, we're going to, if they're spending Machado money, this fantasy land, you know, we're paying you, and we're going to put real money into the bullpen and the rest of the starting rotation. And we're not going to just hope that guys who are already in the organization all break out and stay healthy and like play that game again, you know?
Well, that's my big concern with trading Mats and or Wheeler, is that I have no confidence in the front office replacing those guys with anybody.
That's true. I guess if they traded those guys, they would maybe feel like they had to.
You remember who you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, hey, maybe some guys in the minors emerge and make this all a little more clear in a month or two. But yeah.
Thank you, David, for the email. We do appreciate it. I guess sort of to wrap up here, Chris, I think we've pretty much well established that the Mets are not going to win the National League East this year.
I think I would put money on that at this point, yeah.
Yeah. hey, prove us wrong, Mets, please.
Hey, you are in New Jersey. Maybe you can go put money on it for me.
we'll talk after the podcast again. more conversations, not for the air. But yeah, if you had to pick of the teams that are likely to possibly win the East, the Phillies, the Braves, or I guess the Nationals, who are you feeling? Who do you want there?
I would prefer the Phillies. And, you know, that's a weird thing to say, but it's kind of twofold. One, they have nothing to do with the Chase Utley, Shane Victorino, like, era. You know, I truly despised and still do despise Utley.
Yep. Utley, you Butley.
Exactly. And the you know, but those two players transcended any level of player hatred. I hated Chipper Jones because he was good.
Right.
I hated Victorino and Utley as people.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a very stark difference. So one, it's not that
all the Victorino gifts.
Oh yeah. Oh, the most amazing things on the internet. But yeah. It's
if
not
you don't
that
know what
level.
We're talking about guys. Seek them out. Trust me.
Yeah, they're on the site. Yeah. But yeah. So there's not that level of hatred for anybody on that Phillies team. And there's just sort of this like extra little bonus embarrassment for the Mets that they, you know, the Phillies went and got Arrieta and Santana and they didn't even pay them like that much. Their contracts weren't that crazy.
No,
you know, and to just embarrass the Mets that the team that was willing to pay Jake Arrieta and not just go for a bargain with Jason Vargas, you know, went and won the division. And the way the season's gone, Arrieta alone wouldn't have, you know, necessarily saved it. But, you know, there's a clear difference in approach. You know, Carlos Santana is a very different approach to first base than Adrian Gonzalez coming off being released. And, you know, Dom Smith, and maybe we'll get Pete Alonso by the time the season's over. But, yeah, so it's twofold. It's that embarrassment of what the Mets did and the fact that I don't really hate anybody on the Phillies right now. Plus, my hatred of the Braves is never ending, you know. So I will never say that I prefer the Braves to win the division over anybody. And the Nationals might be making themselves irrelevant now, but it would just be hilarious to see, you know, they were hands down the presumptive favorites to win the division. Oh, and it would be great to see him finish third and not make the playoffs at all. I just find, you know, any kind of consensus pick to win a division failing is funny to me, unless it's the Mets.
Of course.
So what about you? Go Phillies? Or
Okay, so if we're being intellectual about this, then I totally understand your go Phillies attitude. There is not a single Philly I even remotely dislike. You know, I just don't care. I feel like Don Draper. I don't think about them at all. You know, it's not there's nobody on that team that like makes my blood boil. Whereas watching the Nationals, Daniel Murphy makes my blood boil. Freddie Freeman makes my blood boil. Just, you know, these classic Met killers that you can't get away from. So there's that. The one objection I have to the Phillies is that I think the Mets will take the wrong lesson from the Phillies because they're the Mets and that's what they do from these things. And I don't think that the Wilpons can feel shame the way you're expecting them to in this fantasy world.
True.
Part of me wants to say the Nationals because I know they'll not win the playoff series. So you're rooting for them to get to the playoffs and then get dropped in the first round because
right, that would be nice.
That's what the Nationals do, you know. So, but I can't rationally expect that to happen over and over again. You know, at some point they're going to win a playoff series, whether I like it or not. And the Braves, you know, I just don't like the Braves. You know, I think you and I are both in the generation where we grew up with the Braves being public enemy number one. And the Braves won the National League East for a long time. And in my opinion, they can go a long time without winning it now. So I guess I'm rooting for the Phillies. I almost, in an absurd way, want the Marlins to somehow go out in front and win the division, because that would just be something you'd never see in baseball ever again.
Right. Yeah. That would be the ultimate troll. Yes.
Yeah. And it's funny because that's like the lead. That is not what Derek Jeter wants to happen. And I love sticking it to Derek Jeter. So if the Marlins winning pisses Jeter off, that's fine.
Yeah.
Somebody essentially described the Jeter front office to me as the plot of The Producers. Like, they're buying a team with the intention of it failing so they can make money on it, you know? And, you know, the Marlins winning the World Series, winning the East, would be springtime for Hitler being a hit, you know? So,
right.
I'm just rooting for the absurdity of that, I guess. But, you know, realistically, yeah, sure. The Phillies are fine. I feel like if the Phillies are doing well, I will be more enticed to make a trip to Philly to see the Phillies and the Mets, because it'll be a more fun atmosphere than going to a half-empty Citizens Bank Park. Even if the Mets are getting their asses kicked, you know, it'll be fun to be there and get a cheesesteak or something.
Yeah, that works.
I wish I had a stronger opinion about this.
Yeah, you know, it's where we are.
Yes, it is. I guess, sort of to wrap up here, is there anything that's happened this season that you're glad we got to witness? Like, for instance, do you think that the emergence of Nimmo and, I guess to a lesser extent, Wheeler have been legit? And those are both things that maybe wouldn't have gotten the same chance if the Mets didn't have their string of injury bad luck or kept their hot streak going. You know, so when we look back on 2018, will those be the two things that we remember from the season?
Yeah, I mean, I think DeGrom has a legitimate chance to win a Cy Young.
That's true.
You know, I know that the win-loss record could factor in there compared to Scherzer, but if the Nationals are bad, you know, it might just really boil down to, you know, the pitching stats that don't involve the rest of the team.
Yeah.
There is that. So that could be something. But yeah, I'm still a little skeptical on Wheeler. But I think Nimmo's for real. You know, I think that is something, you know, we're going to be looking at a guy who finishes the year, hopefully is like a 5, 5.5, 6 win type player. You know, that's a really, really good guy to have on your roster, and especially the way that he's done it. You know, it just seems like a pretty complete player. And, you know, I know his batting line has dipped just a little bit.
He's had a rough go of it the last few weeks.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's still overall good. You know, it hasn't sunk in that line all that much. And just the emergence of major league power in his game, you know, he's at 12 home runs right now. Not that that's an astronomical number of home runs, but, you know, this is a guy who I'm in. I'm fully on board. This, you know, he's a guy who should be playing every day. What on earth they do with the next 2 years of Jay Bruce's contract, I have no idea.
That was my next question, is how do you construct this outfield next season?
I mean, Cespedes, Bruce, platoon, whoever's healthy, right? And then Conforto, Nimmo every day. Man. That is how I have to look at it. And, you know, if Cespedes is fully healthy, then Jay Bruce is not starting in my outfield.
Which will be the worst free agent contract when all is said and done? The Bruce deal or the Bay deal?
It's probably still Bay, right?
I would say that Bruce obviously had a better start to his Mets tenure, but not as a free agent. Not signing with the Mets, like just in terms of the contract, because, you know, Bruce had two seasons where he was not signed as a free agent to play here.
Yeah, I think Bay still. I mean, he's so bad, and they paid him more per year in like earlier years, you know, where if you'd, you know, adjusted the money for time, it would look even worse. Yeah, I'm sticking with Bay.
Okay, I hope you're right. And look, you know, there's still a chance that Bruce is the first baseman of the team for next year.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that is a possibility.
Man, what are you going to do with Dom Smith? That's a whole other conversation.
We got a lot more podcasts coming up.
Yeah, we do. Look forward to that sweet, sweet Dom Smith spectacular in about mid-August, let's say.
Oh, yeah.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Seipler, and I'm back to go over our minor league players for the week for week 12, which is June 24th to the 30th. So, the Las Vegas 51s went 6-4, and that puts them at 38-44 for the season. Binghamton Rumble Ponies went 3-3, and they had a rain postponed game, and they are 38-41 for the year. St. Lucie Mets went 3-2, and they also had a rain postponed game, and they are 3-5 in the second half. The Columbia Fireflies went 4-2, and they had a game just outright canceled because of wet grounds, and they are 5-4 in the second half. The Brooklyn Cyclones have cooled down a little bit since the season started, and they went 3-3 this week, which leaves them at 10-6 for the year. The Kingsport Mets also cooled down a little bit, and they went 2-3 this year with a rain postponed game, and are 7-4 for the season. And finally, the GCL Mets went 5-2, and they are 7-4 for the year. Now, our pitcher of the week is Las Vegas right-hander Drew Gagnon. He pitched 7 shutout innings against his former team, the Salt Lake Bees, this week, and he won his first game for the season. He allowed 4 hits, he walked 1, and he struck out 10. So some of you may be wondering, who is Drew Gagnon? Well, the Brewers drafted him a few years ago out of Cal State Long Beach. He slowly climbed up through the system for a few years, and he made it as high as their AAA affiliate, the Colorado Sky Sox. But he never got a promotion to the majors, and was basically minor league filler, and he was traded to the Angels in exchange for catcher Jet Brandy. And he didn't have a great year when he was with the Angels. He was there for 1 year, he played with the Salt Lake Bees, and because he wasn't that great, he again missed out on getting promoted to the majors. And then he signed with the Mets this past December, and he spent most of his time with Las Vegas so far this year. And for the season, he's posted a 4.78 ERA in 90.1 innings, allowing 85 hits, walking 26, and striking out 94. So Gagnon is a decent fastball. It sits in the low 90s and tops out around 95 or so. But none of his other secondary pitches are better than average, which is a pretty big reason why he hasn't gotten a shot at the major leagues. His slider is eh. His changeup is eh. And even though he's always shown good command of all of his pitches, and that's generally why he's gotten to be where he is right now, you know, in AAA, without a plus pitch, he's kind of topped out there. In theory, a shift to the bullpen could help him, since it would basically help his fastball and give it a few more ticks of velocity, and he'd be able to focus on one off-speed pitch, really his slider, which does sometimes flash above average. But I don't see that really happening. And if it does happen, good luck to him. But I don't think it'll be with the Mets, and kind of I hope it isn't. The team has other internal options that I'd rather see get chances before Gagnon. Nothing against him. But like I was saying last week concerning Nabil Chrismet, when you watch certain players for years, you have more vested interest in seeing them succeed, as opposed to seeing other guys that are brought in as free agents. So I'd rather see a guy like Chrismet get the chance, you know, a guy like Corey Oswalt, Chris Flexen, people who have been in the system for a while now. I'd rather see them get the chances than a guy that kind of comes in, even though Gagnon may have the stuff to succeed in a role like that. And now our hit of the week is another Las Vegas 51s player, this time it's second baseman Jeff McNeil. He went 12-for-31 with 2 doubles, 2 home runs, 7 RBI, 2 walks, 6 strikeouts, and a stolen base. So, McNeil played his first AAA game this year on June 16th, so that's 14 games right now, and he's hitting a cool .397 with them. He's gotten on base in all 14 games, And in 11 of those 14 games, he's gotten on base at least twice, either by drawing a walk and a hit, logging multiple hits. He played in 17 games with the 51s last year when he got promoted in mid-August and closed out the rest of the season there. And he hit 254, 295, 366. So that's a pretty stark difference. And I was looking at his numbers, and I noticed this, and it's actually a little incredible, kind of, when you think about it. But in Binghamton, he hit 327, 402, 626 with a 316 BABIP. Now, a lot of times when you see guys break out and post high batting averages in the minors, it's because they're posting really high BABIPs, you know, sometimes ones that are unsustainable in the long term. Let's look at a couple of guys. Ahmed Rosario, he hit 328, 367, 466 in Las Vegas with a 377 BABIP last year. And then the year before that in Binghamton, he hit 341, 392, 481 with a 433 BABIP. It's the major leagues that he's in now, so obviously he's facing tougher pitchers and better defenders and everything, but regression happened. Mark Reynolds, in 2014, when he was with Binghamton, he hit 355, 430, 422 with a 433 BABIP. And then he hit 333, 385, 479 in Las Vegas later in that year with a 404 BABIP. Again, you know, he played in the majors, but regression happened. Cesar Puello, a couple of years ago, he hit 326, 403, 547 in 2013 with Binghamton, and he did that with the help of a 391 BABIP. Regression happened with him, and a little bit of that good old Mets mishandling of injuries mixed in for good measure. But the point is that McNeil's BABIP is kind of crazy low for the numbers that he's putting up. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's been, like, robbed or anything like that, but with his surface numbers, the average and the OBP, they could have actually been better if his BABIP was unsustainably inflated like some of those other guys. If you just kind of do quick math, a 50-point boost in his BABIP, that would bring his batting average up to 366, and, you know, a 366 BABIP could be something that a guy could sustain for a season, you know, in the minor leagues, especially when they're hitting really good. But anyway, a 50-point boost would bring up to 366, and that would have hiked his batting average up to 354, and his on-base percentage up to 424, plus whatever, you know, whatever gains in slugging percentage, thanks to extra nine hits, would be, you know, possibly being extra base hits. And that brings me to another point about McNeil. It's not just the balls that he's putting in play, but it's also the balls that he's hitting out of play, home runs. One of the biggest differences between his run in Binghamton, you know, and his two-week run in Las Vegas, and how he's been in the past, is his fly ball rate and how many of those fly balls are getting hit out of the park. Now, the last time McNeil was healthy was in 2015, and that was a while ago, so the data is going to be a little skewed because he was considerably younger as compared to today, and a different kind of physical shape, obviously. But in 2015, when he was with the St. Louis Mets, he had a 22.1% line drive percentage, a 41.5 ground ball percentage, a 36.4 fly ball percentage, a 20.9 infield fly ball percentage, and a 0.7% home run to fly ball percentage. Now this year, he's posting a 19.8 line drive rate, a 30.5 ground ball percentage, a 49.7 fly ball percentage, a 12.9 infield fly ball percentage, and a 15.1% home run to fly ball ratio. So the two biggest takeaways here are that A, he's hitting way fewer ground balls, and B, he's hitting more fly balls that are going for home runs. So the strength that we've heard, you know, he put on, even though he's not as ripped as he was a couple of years ago, he's still pretty ripped, and the strength is helping him, obviously. And that launch angle increase, you know, it's all paying its dividends. So it's not, you know, an anomaly, I don't think, at this point. I think that McNeil has become something of a real deal, at least in the minor leagues. In the majors, I don't know how it's going to translate. He's very pull-heavy, so he could fall victim to some major league shifting that'll hurt his batting average. But, you know, you got to give him a chance. And unfortunately, with the Mets right now, with the way that Cabrera has been playing and Frazier, there just really isn't room for a chance right now. So hopefully by the time the trade deadline comes and the Mets infield gets shifted around a bit, hopefully McNeil is still kind of surging like he has been, and hopefully gets a promotion, and we'll see. So those are our plays of the week for week 12. And again, I'm Steve Saipa, and I'll be back next week for plays of the week for week 13.
Folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for joining us. We truly appreciate it. You can go to AmazingAvenue.com, where we have all sorts of Mets content, depressing as it may be. There's lots of good stuff there. We recap every game. We preview every series. We talk about the farm. We do mind bogglers on Mondays. We do performance meters also on Mondays. Pimping a lot of Monday content today, folks. Go there. Check it out. You'll enjoy it. You can also find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can get this show, the show you're listening to right now, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, or directly from blogtalkradio.com. We ask that when you get the show, you rate, review, and subscribe it. Those things really do help us, and we appreciate it. We'll be your friends forever, we promise. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. I am at Brian Needs a Nap, Chris is at Chris McShane, and Steve is at Steve Saipa. So next week, hopefully, we'll have some good stuff to talk about. The Mets have won two of the last three games. They're 2-1 in July. So there's that, I guess. And whatever happens, you can hear about it right here at Amazing Avenue Audio. So until next time, let's go Mets.